You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Which is more effective, large-scale conservation practices with lots of funding, or more modest but localized organizations? International NGOs like the Nature Conservancy and the World Wildlife Fund have contributed a lot to global conservation efforts, but some scientists and policymakers worry that conservation is being corporatized at the expense of local programs and leadership. With me now for the first part of today's Underreported are Dr. Mary Pearl, president of Wildlife Trust, and John Paul Rodriguez of the Center for Ecology of the Venezuelan Institute for Scientific Investigations. I'm very pleased to welcome them both to the show. Hello.
Hi.
Hello. It's a pleasure to be here.
What sort of size differences are we talking about between the big NGOs and the smaller local conservation groups, Mary?
Well, the smaller groups would have budgets anywhere from $250,000 to maybe $8 million, but the big ones can have budgets up to $50 to $100 million.
And what are the major NGOs in the field?
The Nature Conservancy, Conservation International, the World Wildlife Fund.
And they all say world, so they're all international in scope?
Well, no, the article that we published this week that we're going to talk about that appeared in Science really dealt with the international practice of conservation, and that's where we focus our energy. But, of course, the Sierra Club, there are many, the Audubon Society, there are many large groups in the U.S. as well.
John Paul, are any of those large NGOs in Venezuela?
Yes, absolutely. They are in Venezuela. They have been for a while, and many, in fact, were fundamental for the establishment of the Venezuelan Conservation Group. And Mary, for example, mentioned the Audubon Society was probably the oldest solid, well-organized conservation group in Venezuela, was motivated by National Audubon. So we have a long history of very positive interactions.
Have things changed at all since Hugo Chavez came to power?
Well, there has been a big emphasis on social organizations. The environmental movement is a little bit less of a priority. Recently, there has been an increase in funding for science and technology, and some of that has trickled down to the conservation movement. So I would say that the change during Chavez's tenure has not been against the environmental movement, but in favor of others. More socially oriented movement, and as a consequence, then we are a lesser priority.
Now, the NGO that you started, would we describe this as a small local one?
Yes, absolutely. I think it's in the order of less than $1 million a year budget, a small organization.
And Dr. Pearl, is your group, the Wildlife Trust, one of the big NGOs?
No, we're small as well. Our annual budget's around $6 million.
So we're really talking to people who believe that small is better here.
Well, I've worked at large NGOs as well. I've worked for World Wildlife Fund. I've worked for Wildlife Conservation Society. I don't think it's I'd like to reframe it a little bit. I think what John Paul and I have written about is the issue that problem solving can occur at various distances from the problem at hand. So what we were drawing attention to is the fact that there can be complementarity when problems are approached from a local scale and a distant scale.
Obviously, the big groups have a lot of funding, and so they can do certain things that small groups can't. But people who are in the area, who have a more intimate knowledge of the problem at hand, bring something to it that an international organization can't.
Exactly. I'll give you an example where a big NGO is great. That would be, say, major issues of greenhouse gas emissions. Large-scale solutions are possible because there can be source fixes. For example, a big company can change its policies on that affect emission, or there can be macro solutions of a policy nature that are regional and international. But then when it comes down to protecting ecosystem health on a local scale, there are social issues and contexts that really are best addressed by people closest to the problems.
And how does that work in your situation, John Paul?
Yeah, well, maybe we can use another example. When policy is made, it requires both top-down and bottom-up contributions. Like, for example, you think of the U.S. policy in the U.S., lots of things happen in Congress, but lots of things happen in town meetings. And as the town meeting information trickles up towards the county and state level, the information from the federal government trickles down, and somewhere in the middle they meet. Well, what we feel that our problem is that we don't have this town meeting level. Well, it's not solid enough. There's very few of us. We're very small, and we need to be able to have a stronger voice coming up from these local organizations. And neither in the global conservation plan, there's not much room for these local efforts, just because it's such a vast array of organizations and people. And what we're trying to do with the Wildlife Trust Alliance is to provide a space so that this large organization, this global organization, we build it through small building blocks rather than through a big corporate approach. So we have a slightly different vision of how to build this bottom-up component of policy.
Yes, the Wildlife Trust Alliance that Jean-Paul refers to is an egalitarian network of small conservation organizations from around the world. And what we're trying to do now is to marry the advantages of being close to the problems with the power of having a voice in the international arena.
But in all organizations, there's usually not an alliance like this, but in most organizations, there's usually some kind of a top-down decision-making process. I would assume that in the smaller organizations, there's just a shorter distance between the top and the bottom.
Yes, and that's a meaningful difference, because it means there is more accountability when the chain of responsibility is quite short.
Well, how do you measure the success of a conservation group? Is there an agreement on what constitutes good conservation practices? I mean, how can you tell if an NGO is effective, whether it's big or small?
That's an excellent question, and I think that people can be discerning about whether conservation organizations get results by reading the annual report very carefully. What are the goals that were established? What's the mission of the organization? For example, Wildlife Trust's mission is to empower local conservation scientists worldwide to protect nature. So in some sense, we're doing that on this program. So if you also look to see whether the organization has a good rating from a group like Charity Navigator, a web-based group that looks at the fiscal management and probity of charities, some 5,000 U.S. charities. Another way is to look, has there been external evaluation? Does the organization simply send out its own propaganda, or does it get kudos from in terms of awards, in terms of publication in serious journals, that sort of thing?
Jean-Paul, how would you measure the success of your group, the Center for Ecology of the Venezuelan Institute for Scientific
Investigations? Well, our field projects are comparatively easy to measure than a large organization, because what we do is that we save species, so we increase our population size, and we decrease poaching. So we monitor a series of indicators in the field that are directly impacted by our activities. And for example, we work very closely with the population of parrots on Margarita Island, which is a Caribbean island in Venezuela. When we started working, there were about 650 individuals of a species of parrot that was in 1989, and now there are over 2,000. So it's that kind of very clear-cut indicator that we tend to use as the measure of success. We also focus a lot on the proportion of funds that are spent in programs versus the proportion that is spent in administration. And we think that an effective organization that is focused on conservation should have a maximum of a 30%, 35% spent on administration. And we strive to reach that target.
When the goals are long-term, are they harder to measure?
Yes, absolutely. And the really paradox, the very interesting thing is that success is our worst enemy, because, for example, if we start working on the conservation of a threatened species and we succeed, then it stops being threatened and we lose our funding. So assuring some kind of sustained income for the project, whether it is through some kind of endowment or development of a local ecotourism venture associated with the species that will actually benefit from having more individuals, that's another one of the challenges, is to succeed but yet maintain the flow of funds flowing.
You actually have given the idea for a movie in which an organization is too successful, sees itself threatened, and goes out and undermines its own work.
Believe me, we have thought about that.
Oh, believe me, there are. Would that there are so few environmental problems that we run out.
My guests are Dr. Mary Pearl, president of Wildlife Trust, and John Paul Rodriguez of the Center for Ecology of the Venezuelan Institute for Scientific Investigations. We are talking about large versus small in conservation groups on today's Underreported. Well, how does an international presence change the way an NGO operates? I'm assuming the organization has a lot more clout. If a famous organization identifies a problem and says, we're going to try to do something in Papua New Guinea, for example.
Well, it cuts both ways. The arrival of a big and well-known NGO can create problems because suddenly the most appropriate collaborators are pushed aside by more effective reapers of international aid, for example. Sometimes it's necessary to have an international arrival can often be the occasion where a local scientist who's been trying to get into a government office finally succeeds. So actually, one of the ways that John Paul's organization and my organization work together is we have a pincer view of bringing resources to conservation. Sometimes it's the pincer from the south and sometimes from the north, and we work together to deliver.
Well, John Paul, does your NGO, Provita is its name, right?
Right.
Does it find itself in competition with some of the larger NGOs?
Well, we have had so far very little of it because the large NGOs have worked in Venezuela mainly in collaboration with local organizations or in programs that are so different than the ones that we developed that we end up not really overlapping that much. But that's mainly because in Venezuela the conservation movement in general is very small and the conservation organizations are very small. So other countries that have a much larger activity, that is more prevalent. But so far for us, it hasn't been so bad. Now, as I said before, that's because there isn't much money going around. So,
well, Venezuela has a fair amount of money from its oil reserves, but it also has a rainforest. And the rainforest in Brazil is under serious attack. Mm-hmm. Is the same sort of thing happening in Venezuela?
Yeah, Venezuela has, very interestingly, the country is split sort of in two halves, the north and south. In the south, that's delimited by the Orinoco River, which is a very large river. And most of the human population lives in the north, and most of the oil activity is also in the north. So the southern half of the country, which is about 500,000 square kilometers, has a couple of fairly intensely developed areas that are associated with gold and the diamond mining primarily. But we have vast, vast extensions of forest that are virtually untouched. The only people who live there are traditional Amerindians who've been doing it for tens of thousands of years, so they have figured out their interaction quite well. And so the country has this northern part that is heavily converted and impacted and the southern part that isn't. And there's not much demand for it for the time being. It might change in the future.
So we haven't seen deforestation of the sort that we've seen in Brazil?
Not in the Amazon part of Venezuela. In the northern part, yes. Although all that is left in terms of montane forests, primarily forests that are on mountains, all that is left is protected, most of it. And so there's some very nice tracts of forest also in the northern part of the country.
I'd like to get back to your point, Leonard, about whether there's a competition between activities with the international NGO and a local NGO, because the article that John Paul and I worked on for this week's Science was also co-authored by people from 11 countries in all. And in some of them, there is this problem because local organizations tend to frame problems differently. So there isn't the direct competition, but problems of the environment are often quite complex because they involve human behavior and interacting with the environment. So it can be very complex. And when an external organization comes in with a slogan such as, you know, the last wonderful spots or universal eco regions, then that's very difficult to implement on the ground. So there a mismatch occurs. And this is one of the problems that we see in conservation on the ground, that those close to the problems who are identifying complex, multi-layered problems that involve social parameters as well as natural ones really have a hard time competing with a slogan coming in from outside.
What about competing for funding? I get a lot of mail from the Nature Conservancy asking for donations. Are the bigger NGOs more financed by individual contributions than the smaller ones?
Yeah, there's one really interesting difference between developing world and developed world organizations, and is that the developed world organizations have two large sources of unrestricted funds. One of them is membership, and the other one is endowments. And these two sources of funds allow them to retain a degree of independence and continuity. Now, neither of those two things are very well developed in the developing world, certainly not in Venezuela. So we are trapped by having to fund organizations through projects and to latch on to whatever agendas are available. So what Mary is saying is very important, because sometimes we end up just having to pick whatever is available, and that might be conservation priorities and agendas that are established not in the country but elsewhere. I'm not saying they're bad agendas, but they might not be the best tuned ones to the local reality. So we sort of wax and wane with what funds are available, and have a very hard time maintaining a constant program and a long-term goal that is the same.
And that's, in fact, one of my jobs, is to try to mitigate that waxing and waning by raising money for core costs of developing nation conservation organizations. That's how we strengthen local institutions, which is part of our philosophy. But that's tough fundraising, because most funders that are foundations, for example, want to have a specific activity. And not long ago on the front page of the business section of the Times, a philanthropist who was a former Goldman Sachs partner was appalled at how nonprofits have to raise money. He says it's as if you raise capital for a UPS and you said, well, here's the funding, but you can only buy trucks in Indiana with this money. We are constantly facing that battle.
Well, you mentioned the slogans. Don't the slogans of the large groups, don't they also have a positive effect because they raise public awareness?
They raise public awareness and they raise money, and as marketing tools, they're terrific. When it comes to then implementing them on the ground, it's a little more difficult. Take hotspots as an example. Conservation International promotes hotspots. That if you and it's been a wonderful campaign, and for the places that are hotspots, it's brought wonderful results. There are a couple of problems though. First of all, not everyone lives in a hotspot, but everyone deserves to live in a functioning ecosystem. So everyone needs tools to evaluate the viability of their ecosystems. The other problem with focusing on just hotspots is the reality of nature, especially in the context of climate change, is that there are just rapid, fast-paced, globalized threats to nature. It's not just the indirect effects of climate change, but they're fast-moving invasive species. I mean, even in our own country, there are some 50,000 invasive species, and it's been estimated that over 40% of our endangered species are threatened because of invasives. So we have a very dynamic system, and I haven't even mentioned the marine environment, which can't be a hot spot. So this is the problem with trying to use something that's really good for marketing and awareness building to implementation.
Now, we've seen in some of the other kinds of hot spots, the political hot spots of the world, where NGOs are often viewed with a certain amount of suspicion as arms of Western political or economic forces. How does that work in this area? If officials from Conservation International or another big group came into a small town in Bolivia to try to set up protected areas, what kind of response might they get?
Well, I'm sure that that's a very variable. There are examples where such a strategy might have succeeded and examples where it hasn't. But what is clear is that the fundamental element for a protected area to succeed is that it has local support. As Mary said before, sometimes a large organization can tip the scale in favor of local conservationists by raising their profile and making them visible. But on the other,
where they can train them and equip them, give them funding,
well, that's fundamental,
and then perhaps
yes,
hold them to high standards.
We looked at, in our article, we report the figures of spending in conservation in Latin America and the Caribbean. I can't remember the exact time interval, but only 4% of that total fund spend was devoted to capacity building. Well, if you think, you know, if you spend 96% of a budget and you don't have the local institutions to absorb it and to implement and keep it going in the long term, then it's very likely that a lot of that money is going to be wasted. So what we're trying to do is that we welcome, I mean, the Wildlife Trust Alliance is an alliance of organizations from developing world and developed world. We are all for these alliances and these, we all have, as Mary pointed out before, we can, by having both sides of the coin, we can package our projects more efficiently to the eyes of different interested parties. But the key is that the actual implementation of the project has to, above all, consider the local context and assure that whatever the perceptions of the people there are taken into account.
When the big NGOs come in, do they sometimes overwhelm the smaller groups, Mary?
I think actually John Paul might be a better respondent on what it feels like when a large group comes in. Sometimes, I mean, I remember once popping up, I was in Brazil with our partner, the Institute for Ecological Research there, and we were bobbing up and down in a rowboat looking at a colony of magnificent Brazilian Amazon parrots that roost in a colonial way, and it was hilarious because we were bobbing and we were very close, but we were watching the birds come in, and suddenly an enormous yacht came by, followed by a boat with bodyguards, and it was one of the big NGOs that had brought the CEO of a big American company to see the very same thing, and it was almost a perfect analogy. I mean, their wake was making us almost capsize, but at the same time, they couldn't get in very close to see the parrots because of the draw of the hull of the boat. I was wondering if listeners might want to download this article that we keep talking about.
Yeah, article is co-authored by a panel of scientists, and you and Jean-Paul are two of the contributors. It's in this week's Science magazine. It's at sciencemag.org. Is that how?
Yes,
they get
or
to
people can go to our website, wildlifetrust.org, and download the article there as well.
Now, how should our listeners support conservation groups to make sure that they, when they donate money, they get the most bang for their buck?
Well, I think we're fortunate in that it's not like televangelism. There are really no bad conservation organizations that are not doing what people would want. I mean, I don't think there's a conservation organization out there that is a negative. So I think the good news is that people have an opportunity to really choose the kind of thing that turns them on, whether it's they really just have to save elephants or they're interested in fresh water issues. But if people are interested in strengthening local institutions for conservation, I don't think they could make a better investment than Wildlife Trust. I can be self-serving.
Well, of course,
for a minute.
Yeah, the part of the problem is that we may know about the big ones, but
yes,
we don't even know about some of the small ones that are out there doing work. In the case of Provita, I'm assuming, John Paul, most of the people who contribute are in Venezuela.
No, well, we have a large portion of our funds come from international sources. We do have some Venezuelan contributors, and one thing that we're working very hard on now is in thinking about innovative ways to assure funds from local sources. But it's not easy, because if you think that, I mean, people here might not be aware of different conservation organizations. Well, in places like Venezuela, there's very little tradition to donate money at all. So getting people to do it is a challenge. It's a challenge, but we're innovating.
We're also finding that multinational corporations that have a tradition of philanthropy that may be based in America or Europe are exporting that philosophy, and that's a very promising source of funds internationally.
I want to thank you both so much for being with us. By the way, I'm informed that a link to the article in Science Magazine will be put on our website, at WNYC.org. Just another way to access it. Dr. Mary Pearl, president of Wildlife Trust, John Paul Rodriguez of Provita in Venezuela. Thank you both so much for participating in today's Underreported.
Thank you.
Thank you.